Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. What a week it's been. We've got Taylor Swift's new album, plenty of articles about that. We've got a former president on trial. We've got a lot to cover there too. So stay tuned for a packed hour of current events. And of course, we'll see what Bess Levin is reporting about all of this. Let's start with a positive highlight of the week. Taylor Swift smashes several Spotify records in a single day. As of 4:20, Taylor Swift's new album is on a streaming high. This is by Eve Beatty, published on April 20th. Taylor Swift is riding high on 4:20, but not for the reasons you might think. Though she's currently on a break from her Eras tour, the billionaire singer is hard at work promoting her new double album, The Tortured Poets Department, which was released first thing on Friday. Later that day, she announced its first single, dropped its first video, and announced a related social media challenge. All that hustling paid off Saturday, as music platform Spotify has announced that she's smashed the streamers, and in several cases her own, records across multiple categories in only one day. On Friday, Spotify announced on X, formerly Twitter, that TTPD, which is the Tortured Poets Department, was its most streamed album in a single day. But at the time, that stat was quantified as over 200 million streams. Even that number put it heads and shoulders above the previous record holder, who also happens to be Taylor Swift. Her albums 1989, Taylor's Version, and Midnights had previously owned those top slots. Spotify revised that streaming figure Saturday, saying the final one-day tally was over 300 million and the first album in its history to reach that benchmark. Swift is also the most streamed artist in a single day on Spotify history, the company announced. As with the album achievement, we don't need to worry about the feelings of the previous title holder, as the last record was set on October 27th, 2023, by none other than Taylor Swift, who had just released 1989, Taylor's Version. And the hits keep coming, as Spotify tweeted on Saturday that the first single from TTPD, Fortnite, became Spotify's most streamed song in a single day. As of publication time, the company has not announced how many streams it took to achieve that distinction. For the sake of comparison, however, it was reported late last year that Mariah Carey's 1994 holiday song, All I Want for Christmas Is You, set a single-day streaming record on December 24th, 2023, with 23,701,697 streams. Carey was also Spotify's top single-day song stream artist the previous Christmas Eve, when the same tune received 21,273,357 streams. So is Swift the Grinch who just stole Christmas? Spotify isn't saying anything, and Vanity Fair's request for more info was not responded to at the time of publication. But while some might not have predicted that Spotify's previous top one-day single was a 30-year-old holiday song, it was easy to know that TTPD was going to achieve new heights. And we're not just talking about her boyfriend's sellout merch and podcast, which has made some Spotify chart noise as well. Even before its release, TTPD had Spotify's most pre-saved album countdown page in history, the company said via press release, so Swift's dominance this weekend was probably as inevitable as Travis Kelce's recent gridiron triumph. High times indeed. There are so many articles about Taylor Swift and her new album, but I thought this one was most interesting. Stevie Nicks wrote a poem for Taylor Swift's new album, The Tortured Poets Department. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 19th. As if 31 tracks and more lyrical burns than an emergency room waiting room on the 4th of July wasn't enough to work with, Taylor Swift's new album, double album, The Tortured Poets Department, also features an original poem penned by none other than Stevie Nicks. Physical copies of the album feature a poem by the Fleetwood Mac icon, which lacks a title apart from A Poem by Stevie Nicks, and bears a handwritten date, September 13th, 8:50 p.m., and dedication, for T and me. The poem, aptly for the subject matter of the album, is about heartbreak and the end of a relationship. It reads, September 13th, 8:50 p.m., a poem by Stevie Nicks. He was in love with her, or at least she thought so. She was brokenhearted. Maybe he was too. Neither of them knew. She was way too hot to handle. He was way too high to try. He couldn't even see her. He wouldn't open his eyes. She was on her way to the stars. He didn't say goodbye. She looked back from her future and shed a few tears. He looked into his past and actually felt fear. For both of them, the answers would never be ever clear. Don't ask questions now. Do that later. She brings joy. He brings Shakespeare. It's almost a tragedy, says she. Don't endanger me. Don't endanger me. He really can't answer her. He's afraid of her. He's hiding from her. And he knows that he's hurting her. She tells the truth. She writes about it. She's an informer. He's an ex-lover. There's nothing there for her. She's already gone. There's nothing that can stop her. She was just flying through the clouds where he saw her. She was just making her way to the stars when he lost her. For Tea and Me. Nicks and Swift are no strangers. They've performed together, have vocally been fans of one another, and have been compared to one another. The latest comparison coming from Swift herself on the TTPD track, Clara Bow. The song is about that quintessential idea of making it and becoming the it girl. Bow, a silent film star, is considered to have pioneered the archetype. You look like Stevie Nicks. In 75, the hair and lips. Crowd goes wild at her fingertips. Half moonshine, a full eclipse. One verse begins with the final lines invoking Swift's name, looking into a future where she's just another icon of the past. You look like Taylor Swift in this light. We're loving it. You've got an edge she never did. The future's bright, dazzling. Nicks has also praised Swift through the years and in October 2023 thanked her on stage for writing the Midnights track, You're On Your Own, Kid, invoking the song as an example of how she felt about bandmate Christine McVie, who died in 2022, and why she couldn't see Fleetwood Mac touring again without McVie. That was Christine and I. We were on our own in that band. We always were. We protected each other, she said. Who am I going to look over to on the right and have them not be there behind that Hammond organ? When she died, I figured we really can't go any further with this. There's no reason to. In related news, Kayla Nicole, Travis Kelce's ex-girlfriend, has reached her breaking point. This is also by Casey Wickman, published on April 19th. Kayla Nicole, Travis Kelce's ex-girlfriend, is speaking out about the constant vitriol she's received online. I'm unproblematic, the on-air host wrote Thursday on X, formerly Twitter. Mind my business, never respond to the constant vitriol. Solid as they come, and don't expect a pat on the back for it either. Just know everyone has a breaking point and would love for y'all, because you know exactly who you are, to leave me alone. Nicole's message comes as Taylor Swift's new album, The Tortured Poets Department, hit shelves Friday. It's been speculated that some of the album's lyrics reference Kelce, whom Swift is currently dating. Nicole and Kelce, the star tight end for the Kansas City Chiefs, who took home his second consecutive Super Bowl championship ring this year, dated on and off from 2017 to 2022. Since Kelce and Swift's relationship went public in the fall of 2023, Nicole has been tugged into the conversation several times for comments that do not directly address Swift. In another tweet posted Thursday, Nicole wrote, "There's just no way I can fully digest all these new albums. I'm still on Cowboy Carter, overstimulated.com. It seems to draw the ire of some Swifties who interpreted the comment as a slam on Swift's forthcoming The Tortured Poets Department. Taylor doesn't need your streams," one wrote. After Nicole asked to be left alone on the subsequent tweet, one response advised her to log off. Nicole declined, firing off another barb. "I made 6 real-life figures from being logged on last year," she wrote, "and very thankful for it. A better suggestion, people that use this platform to spew hate, log out and focus on getting their mattress off the floor." On Friday, she appeared to be ready to move on from the discussion, tweeting, "Today is going to be a great day." In October 2023, shortly after Swift and Kelsey's relationship became public, Nicole shared an open letter amid what she referred to as backlash, again, not calling out any specific names or events, encouraging followers to preserve your heart. "Even though sometimes I too ask, why me, I'm reminded that this isn't about me," she said. "My truth, trauma, and vulnerability is a relatable part of the human experience. I know I'm not alone, and I want to make sure that you know that you're not alone either." A request for comment from Kayla Nicole has not been returned. We're headed to the Hollywood section to talk about some upcoming movies. Bohemian Rhapsodies, Timothy, Leo, Selena, and the boom in musician biopics. Why movies on everyone from Bob Dylan to Amy Winehouse to Air Supply, yes, Air Supply, are suddenly headed to the screen. This is by Alan Light, published on April 18th. Hardly a week has gone by this year without the announcement of a new biopic focused on a musician. Some already have major stars attached: Timothy Chalamet as Bob Dylan, Selena Gomez playing Linda Ronstadt, Jeremy Allen White taking on Bruce Springsteen, Coleman Domingo as Nat King Cole. If Frank Sinatra's family approves, we may even get Leonardo DiCaprio as Old Blue Eyes and Jennifer Lawrence as his second wife, Ava Gardner. And there are still more projects rolling our way, including movies in the works about Michael Jackson, the Bee Gees, Anthony Kiedis of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and even 80s wimp rockers Air Supply. Just last month, the white whale was landed with the news that Sam Mendes will be directing a four-part feature series about the Beatles, scheduled for release in 2027. Yes, that's a movie for each of them. In the recent success of Bob Marley, One Love, which has grossed $177 million worldwide, made the potential of these films clear. While early reviews of the Amy Winehouse story, Back to Black, coming in May, reveal the high-wire act required to satisfy both the diehard fans and the artists' families and estates. Clearly, the record-breaking box office of 2018's Bohemian Rhapsody, which was the highest-grossing biopic of all time until last summer's Oppenheimer, followed by hits such as Rocketman and Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, escalated interest in the format. But there are other factors that have been made music-related biopics catch fire. The success of Bohemian Rhapsody raised eyebrows about what could happen when you're successful with a biographical film, says Larry Mestel, CEO of Primary Wave Music, a leading music publisher and talent management company. It's been a big explosion. For many years, artists didn't want to make films that depicted their life story because they were afraid of how it would come out. There's a much greater openness now that there's been a bunch of these films that have done very well. Their success, but also how the stories have been told and the quality being as vivid as it has been. James Keach, who produced the 2005 Johnny Cash biopic Walk the Line and is currently involved in the Ronstadt feature, has seen firsthand how dramatically the market has changed. "It took 13 years to get Walk the Line made," he said, "and it was only because of the success of the Ray Charles film, 2004's Ray, that it got made and then became a huge hit. I think it set the stage for the studios to go, wow, there's an audience out there for this stuff." The early streaming era, with new outlets and opportunities for distribution, saw a boom in music documentaries, including such acclaimed film as Amy, What Happened, Miss Simone, and Get Back. In fact, the subjects of virtually every one of this recent wave of biopics has also already been featured in a doc, which are generally cheaper and quicker to make. "A lot of people start with the documentary and then work their way up," says Mestel. "Documentaries are much smaller ticket items, so they're easier to get done." If you're surprised by some of the names getting the biopic treatment, it's not just that Hollywood is running out of A-list musicians. In the last few years, many of the legendary artists of rock's greatest generation have sold off some combination of their publishing catalog, their recordings, and their name and likeness, sometimes for hundreds of millions of dollars. When an artist sells us their music, part of the conversation is always around, what's the future? How are we going to help market and grow the artist's reach, says Mestel, whose company has acquired the catalogs of such legends as Marley, Prince, James Brown, and Stevie Nicks. Things go in ebbs and flows, but the biographical film seems to be the biggest driver of opportunity for artists. He points to the 2022 movie, I Want to Dance with Somebody. Our Whitney Houston film allowed us to make countless brand deals, and streams went up significantly. With a successful biographical film, you re-engage fans. There's a new youth culture for that artist, and the brand itself dramatically increases. Music biopics have long been Oscar bait. Sissy Spacek for Coal Miner's Daughter, Jamie Foxx for Ray, and Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody are among the trophy winners. But they're hardly a sure thing, as we learned when Kevin Spacey played Bobby Darin in Beyond the Sea and Jennifer Hudson took on Aretha Franklin in Respect. But especially with such major investments behind these historic catalogs, there's greater motivation for the high-risk, high-reward opportunity. There's risks every time you get on the freeway, but you gotta get there, says Keach. Of course, everybody wants to recoup their investment, and if you invest $100 million or something, you're not gonna sit around and go, gee, I wonder what we're gonna do today. You better get out there and get some of that money back. We love the stories of musicians because they're full of struggle and scandal, the dark and the light, but these films always require a negotiation with the families and estates about what exactly they're willing to address in exchange for allowing the music to be used. Initial responses to Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson, have praised Marisa Abella's performance as Amy Winehouse, but suggested the film soft-pedals the roles of her father, Mitch Winehouse, and her ex-husband, Blake Fielder Civil, played in the singer's tragic trajectory. None of these projects, however, seems as fraught as Michael, the Antoine Fuqua-directed Michael Jackson biopic scheduled to premiere in April 2025. Will his estate, especially given that its co-executors, John Branca and John McClane, are producers of the film, permit the depiction of such issues as allegations of sexual abuse by Jackson and his treatment at the hands of his father? Producer Graham King, who also served as a producer on Bohemian Rhapsody, has insisted that the film will get into all of it, describing Jackson as a man with a very complicated life. It's not just about making the film and putting it up on the screen. It's about protecting the legacy, says Mestel, who says his company is now developing more movies about Boy George and Bing Crosby. You want the story told properly, the right story and the true story, but we've learned that it's also very important to tell the story that the artist or the family, the heirs, are comfortable with. We're about to find out who can walk that tightrope without falling off. The Hollywood section is going to lead us into politics. This headline reads, Donald Trump's reported courtroom nap awakens Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. This is by Savannah Walsh, published on the 16th. The moment that the world learned Donald Trump reportedly had an impromptu snooze on the first day of his hush money trial, late night TV writers everywhere rubbed their hands together in glee. After years of anticipation, the first criminal trial of a former president has begun, Jon Stewart stated on Monday's episode of The Daily Show, and by all accounts, it's absolutely riveting. He went on to share a clip of New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman telling CNN's Jake Tapper about the courtroom nap, which Trump's campaign has naturally denied ever happened. The incident itself could not be caught on camera, as those weren't permitted in the courtroom. Trump appears to be sleeping. His head keeps dropping down and his mouth goes slack, Tapper said, reading Haberman's earlier observation and then imploring the journalist to tell us about that. She replied, "Well, Jake, he appeared to be asleep." "Hey, Jake, what part of head down, eyes closed, drool coming out of his mouth do you not fucking get over here?" teased Stewart. "Imagine committing so many crimes you get bored at your own trial." Before moving on, Stewart recapped what the Trump trial is about and what's at stake. Now, in case you've lost track, this is the trial where Trump allegedly paid hush money to an adult film star that he slept with and then allegedly falsified business records to cover it up. Or, as Trump would put it, The host then cut to a clip of Trump claiming that the trial is a political persecution and an assault on America, which is why I'm very proud to be here. Stewart's response? Well, it's true. Trump is always very proud to be part of any assault on America. Over on The Late Show, Stephen Colbert imitated Trump's mid-slumber musings during his monologue. "Oh my God, I was having the most terrible dream that I had to read something," he said in the former president's singular cadence. "Oh no, the dream was real. But if it's real, then where's the hamburger with boobs?" Jimmy Kimmel also dedicated a sizable portion of Monday's monologue to bashing Trump. "If Biden is Sleepy Joe, I guess that makes you Dozo the Clown," Jimmy Kimmel said. "Imagine if Joe Biden fell asleep in the court on the first day of his trial," he continued. "Trump would be calling him Comatose Joe. Fox News would be talking about this until Christmas, but not old Donnie Napleseed." All in all, the late night host concluded, "It's nice to see even Donald Trump is exhausted by Donald Trump." We're going to go to an Inside the Hive article before we get fully into the politics section. 25 years after Columbine, why the massacre was a turning point for America. Columbine author Dave Cullen reflects on the cultural impact of the Colorado school shooting and why he keeps coming back to the story. This is by Brian Stelter, published on April 18th. In the words of author Dave Cullen, the Columbine High School massacre was not the first mass shooting, but it definitely started the mass shooter era. That era is now a quarter century old. The 25th anniversary of the Columbine shooting is on Saturday, leading journalists and elected officials to commemorate the moment when, as Cullen put it, all hell had broken out in this suburb of Denver. Cullen, who wrote the definitive book on Columbine, reflected on the impact of the school shooting on this week's episode of Inside the Hive, which also includes the interview with Vanity Fair's Dan Adler on covering Donald Trump's hush money trial. "In the wake of Columbine," Cullen said, "parents across the country suddenly wondered, am I sending my kid off to die? And the same fears are still palpable today." The author compared the massacre to a couple of landmark events that reshaped public opinion. Vietnam and Watergate, together, are famous for having destroyed America's faith in institutions, and I think Columbine was another version of that. "There's this massive problem of gun deaths in America," he said, "and it proved that we couldn't solve it and that we just had to give up, that we were powerless. After Columbine, we thought everything was going to change, and it didn't. The massacres of college students at Virginia Tech and elementary school students at Sandy Hook reinforced this belief," he added. But Columbine did spur changes in other realms. Law enforcement protocols for active shooter situations changed drastically, Cullen pointed out. Schools implemented a wide array of new security measures. "I talk about depression as the great unlearned lesson of Columbine," Cullen said. "Experts have comprehensive tools for screening and treating teen depression, but they're not used widely enough." In the updated preface to his book, Cullen writes that he has tried to leave the Columbine story many times, but "I keep coming back," he said, "because it keeps happening. Numerous mass murderers were inspired by the killers, and Cullen said he has nightmares of a spiderweb of all these mass shootings coming out of Columbine." Before we get to all the news about the Trump trial this past week, we're going to turn to a little foreign news. Despite intense GOP infighting, House passes a $95 billion foreign aid package. This is by Jack McCordick, published on April 21st. After months of escalating tensions, the House overwhelmingly passed a $95 billion foreign aid package Saturday, despite a majority of Republicans voting against additional funding for Ukraine. The three-bill package, which includes $61 billion for Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, including $9 billion earmarked for humanitarian aid in Gaza, and $8 billion for U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific, was spearheaded by Speaker Mike Johnson, who has faced a revolt from the far-right flank of the GOP over his support for Ukraine. For the past month, Johnson has been staring down the specter of a motion to vacate his speakership, wielded by Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Last week, her promise to push forward with her effort to oust Johnson earned the support of Kentucky Representative Thomas Massie and Arizona Representative Paul Gosar, which, given the GOP's razor-slim House majority, would be enough to boot Johnson if no Democrats came to his aid. But Green appeared to back down on Saturday, at least temporarily, saying she had decided against immediately bringing up the motion. Instead, she said she wanted House Republicans to hear from their voters first. Mike Johnson betrayed America once again, she wrote on X, formerly Twitter. House Republicans and the American people would be stronger without his disloyalty and betrayal of his principles. Now it's time for my colleagues to go home and hear from their constituents. The pressure is already building. Massie, one of the most vocal opponents of Ukraine aid in the House, told Politico Sunday, "It's going to be inevitable, especially now that Johnson has chosen his path with the Democrats. Like, once you go there, it's hard to go back." After the vote, Johnson addressed the threat from his far-right flank, telling reporters he doesn't walk around this building being worried about a motion to vacate. "I have to do my job." The House Speaker added, "I've done here what I believe to be the right thing to allow the House to work its will." As the vote on Ukraine aid appeared to set to pass, several Democrats waved small Ukrainian flags, prompting boos from some Republicans opposed to the measure. In a statement, President Joe Biden praised both parties for coming together to answer history's call, passing urgently needed national security legislation that I've fought for months to secure. He urged the Senate, which passed a similar measure in February, to quickly send this package to my desk so that I can sign it into law and we can quickly send weapons and equipment to Ukraine to meet their urgent battlefield needs. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky took to X immediately after the bill's passage to personally thank Speaker Mike Johnson and all American hearts who believe, as we do in Ukraine, that Russian evil must not be winning. On Sunday, speaking on NBC News' Meet the Press, the embattled leader said the U.S. support will really strengthen the armed forces, I pray, and we will have a chance at victory if Ukraine really gets the weapons system, which we need so much, with thousands of soldiers need so much. Our next headline in the campaign coffers, Donald Trump's massive legal bills are nearly bankrupting his major PAC. This is by Jack McCordick, published on April 21st. Former President Donald Trump's sprawling criminal cases are draining the coffers of Save America, his leadership PAC, limiting the amount it can spend on his re-election campaign. According to a report filed with the Federal Election Commission on Saturday, Save America spent nearly $3.7 million on Trump's legal fees in March, just about the same amount as the presumptive GOP nominee's official campaign committee spent on his re-election bid during the same time period. The legal spending accounted for nearly three-quarters of the money the PAC collected that month, CNN reported. Slightly under one-third of the $3.7 million went to Blanche Law and Neschel's Law, LLP, the two law firms representing the former president in his hush money trial in New York, where opening statements are expected to get underway on Monday after jury selection wrapped up last week. In addition to the hush money cases, Trump faces three other criminal cases that have yet to go to trial, as well as a nine-figure judgment in a civil case. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about the money that the Trump campaign is spending on his legal bills. Let's continue. Overall, Save America has spent nearly $60 million on Trump's legal cases since the beginning of last year, Politico reported. In order to remain solvent, the leadership PAC has been taking refunds from a Trump super PAC called MAGA Inc., which Save America helped bankroll with a $60 million cash infusion. MAGA Inc. has sent Save America $5 million refunds every month for nearly a year, though that source of cash is drying up. The super PAC has already given over $57 million back to the leadership PAC and won't be able to contribute more refunds once it reaches the $60 million mark. The FEC filing comes as Joe Biden's campaign is far outraising and outspending its GOP counterpart. The president's campaign spent nearly $30 million in March, including $22 million on an advertising spree, and still ended the month with $85 million in cash on hand, nearly double Trump's $44 million. As the general election campaign heats up, both candidates have been looking to boost their war chests with high-profile fundraisers. In late March, the Biden campaign raked in $26 million at a star-studded soiree at Radio City Music Hall, New York, in which the president appeared alongside Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, while an early April Trump event in Florida netted him over $50 million, a significant boost that will be reflected in a future campaign finance filing. Okay, let's get into the trial. This headline, how do you find a jury of Donald Trump's peers? Potential jurors in week one of the former president's unprecedented criminal trial were sometimes awed and sometimes repulsed. Could any of them be impartial? This is by Dan Adler, published on April 19th. An IT consultant who lives on the Lower East Side walked into a Manhattan courtroom on Tuesday and sized Donald Trump up. The excitement rose in his voice as he declared that he found the former president fascinating and mysterious. He walks into a room and he sets people off one way or another, the prospective juror went on. I find that really interesting. Really, this one guy can do all of this. Wow, that's what I think. Trump didn't seem to register a reaction. All right, his lead attorney, Todd Blanche, said, more visibly at a loss. Thank you. Assessments such as these, and not all of them so inspired, have comprised the bulk of the first week of the criminal trial of former U.S. president. A series of man-on-the-street impressions of the defining cultural political figure of the last decade delivered as he silently looked on. Jury selection for Trump's case, in which he has pleaded not guilty to falsifying business records in order to cover up an alleged affair with the porn star Stormy Daniels, which he has also denied, began on Monday, and it has, in some ways, provided a measure of his current grip on our collective attention. As potential panelists filed into the courtroom throughout the week, they craned their necks to get a look at Trump. As anyone who has been called to serve in New York can attest, jury duty is one of the few unavoidable common denominators shared in a city of extremes. The pool delivered its dependable cross-section of New York. One woman giggled and put her hand over her mouth, turning to her seatmate to raise her eyebrows. In most instances, the jury candidates came and went. Many said from the outset that they couldn't be impartial in this most charged and high-profile case, and so there was no need for them to be questioned by Trump's lawyers and state prosecutors. When prospective jurors did advance to take the stand, they generally seemed to have something to get off their chest, even as they maintained that they could remain fair. One woman sighed when asked by Trump's lawyer, Susan Neschels, whether she had any strong opinions about the defendant. I'm born and raised in Brooklyn and New York, she said, and I've kind of spent my whole life knowing about Donald Trump. She said once she saw him and his ex-wife Marla Maples shopping for baby stuff at ABC Carpet and Home. She said she'd heard positive things about him, but added that how I feel about him as a president is different. Oh boy, said another candidate, harking back to 1989 when Trump took out a newspaper ad calling for the execution of the falsely imprisoned Central Park Five. Here we go. Going back to Central Park, I knew some of the kids, their cousins. An Italian man explained that the media in his birthplace have had a very strong association with Mr. Trump and Silvio Berlusconi, which made him worry about his ability to retain impartiality. He was excused. A young black woman said that as a person of color, she had friends with strong opinions of Trump, but that she herself wasn't a political person and she appreciated his candor. President Trump speaks his mind, she said, and I'd rather that than someone who's in office who you don't know what they're thinking. She was the only person in the jury box at the time who was unaware that Trump had been charged in three other criminal cases. For all the discussion leading up to the trial in heavily Democratic Manhattan, the baseline view was often closer to the IT consultant's sense of wonder than outright condemnation. He was our president, the owner of a construction firm said, describing himself as a fellow entrepreneur. Pretty amazing. He was a businessman in New York. He forged his way. Through it all, Trump has generally looked bored and is often quite boring and cold. He complained to reporters on Thursday afternoon about this New York scandal trial and how he was sitting here for days now, from morning till night, in that freezing room. Freezing, he repeated. Everybody was freezing in there. With the ceremony of the presidency, for now, stripped away, he was in a dreary courthouse like every other Manhattan criminal defendant on trial. Over the course of this week, District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office released announcements of indictments for rape, murder, and shooting charges throughout the city, as well as for a fatal subway shoving. At present, only 6 reporters are allowed in the courtroom at a time, with the rows there full of prospective jurors. The rest of the press watches via a video feed from an overflow room where Michael Wolff, wearing white pants and suede loafers, peered into the screen on Tuesday. The prevailing question early in the week was whether Trump had dozed off at the defense table, as the New York Times' Maggie Haberman reported, and as the Trump campaign immediately and forcefully denied. Norm Eisen, the legal commentator and former U.S. ambassador to the Czech Republic, joked to Haberman in an elevator that George Conway had also fallen asleep. Later on Tuesday, Trump told reporters on his way out of the courthouse that he was headed to a bodega. In Harlem, the neighborhood where Bragg grew up, a clerk at the convenience store stabbed and killed a man with whom he was fighting in 2022. Bragg's office initially charged him with murder, but after an outcry over whether the worker's actions constituted self-defense, dropped the case. "I love this city, and it's gotten so bad in the last 4 years, Trump told the New York Post, "and we're going to straighten New York out." His visit amounted to a taunt with the district attorney currently trying to his case, so often derided in the conservative press as soft on crime. It was a novelty still, this Queens-born former president making a local spectacle of himself in between appearances at an unprecedented criminal trial. The crowd in Harlem matched or even outstripped the third sitting MAGA crew, including Laura Loomer and Andrew Giuliani, that showed up outside the court on Monday and never returned. There were some hiccups throughout jury selection. The IT consultant was initially chosen as a panelist, but eventually dismissed after some possible discrepancies in his answers emerged. But by the end of the day, Thursday, a jury of 12 was chosen, ahead of opening statements that are expected as early as Monday. The jurors were sworn in and received instructions from Justice Juan Merchan. As they were led out of the courtroom and past the defense table, Trump stared at them. While all this was going on outside, a man dies after setting himself on fire outside Trump hush money trial. Max Azzarello of Florida tossed anti-government conspiracy pamphlets into the air before self-immolating. This is by Jack McCordick, published on April 20th. The man who lit himself on fire on Friday outside the Manhattan courthouse where jury selection for Donald Trump's hush money trial was taking place has died, New York police confirmed to multiple news outlets Saturday morning. The man, identified by police as Max Azzarello, 37, was in Collect Pond Park in Lower Manhattan on Friday when around 1:30 p.m., he threw conspiratorial pamphlets in the air and doused himself in liquid accelerant before lighting himself on fire, according to several reports of the incident. Because there was a significant police presence around the courthouse for Trump's judicial proceedings, dozens of officers quickly attempted to extinguish the blaze, the Associated Press reported. Azzarello was rushed to a local hospital but succumbed to his injuries later that night. Azzarello had lingered outside the same courthouse a day earlier with a sign bearing the name of his Substack newsletter, on which he had also uploaded the pamphlets, the New York Times reported. He had another sign reading, "Trump is with Biden and they're about to fascist coup us." As of Friday, the latest post on the Substack begins, "I have set myself on fire outside the Trump trial." Calling himself an investigative researcher, Azzarello writes that he discovered a plot from our own government, along with many of their allies, to hit us with an apocalyptic fascist world coup. The 2,600-odd word post goes on to rail against cryptocurrency, the Clintons, Harvard University, the Simpsons television show, and more. In an interview with the NYT on Thursday in Collector Pond Park, Azzarello said his views stemmed from his research into American venture capitalist Peter Thiel, whose Founders Fund has been a major crypto investor. Investigators also found his conspiracy theorist screeds on the online manifesto, which claims the digital currency is our first planetary multi-trillion-dollar Ponzi scheme. Azzarello didn't breach any security checkpoints set up for the trial, but New York City Police Department Deputy Commissioner Kaz Dautry said in a Friday news conference, "We may have to shut this area down." Jury selection in Trump's first criminal trial case to go to trial wrapped up on this Friday, and the proceedings are expected to continue with opening statements on Monday. In other election news, this headline reads, "No, Trump's plan to deploy 100,000 poll workers isn't about election integrity." This is by Eric Lutz, published on April 19th. Donald Trump has made his self-serving rigged election lies something like scripture for Republicans, an organizing principle for the party, an oath prospective Republican National Committee staffers apparently must swear before they're hired, glue that binds the MAGA faithful. Now, the Trump campaign and the party apparatus, which have essentially become one and the same, may be planning to use the doubts he sowed about the democratic process in 2020 to undermine it again in 2024. On Thursday, Trump and the RNC announced a historic program to ensure election integrity in November. It will deploy 100,000 dedicated volunteers and attorneys, they said, to serve as poll watchers in battleground states to monitor the process and report any irregularity. Having the right people to count the ballots is just as important as turning out voters on Election Day, Trump said in a statement. Every ballot, every precinct, every processing center, every county, every battleground state, we will be there, added his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, who now serves as co-chair of the RNC. There is nothing inherently nefarious or illegal about partisan election monitoring, which is subject to state regulations, but this particular initiative is troubling, coming as it does in the context of Trump's efforts to subvert the democratic process last cycle, including through the violent insurrection he instigated at the Capitol in 2021 and the way his election fraud conspiracy theories continue to animate his base. Indeed, Trump's lies about the 2020 election, which began well before voters went to the polls that year, served as the basis for his desperate attempts to overturn his loss, which involved legal efforts to discount votes in swing states. He ultimately failed to thwart the election process, but his Republican allies succeeded in using his lies to chip away at voting rights. "There is an unfolding assault taking place in America today," President Joe Biden said in a 2021 speech as states like Florida and Georgia enacted new restrictive voting laws. "An attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in free and fair elections, an assault on democracy, an assault on liberty, an assault on who we are as Americans. That assault is ongoing. As I reported last month, election deniers have not only sought to get their hands on the levers of election system, they have sought to inflict chaos on it by harassing election workers and gumming up the process with frivolous records requests and challenges. It's really this death by a thousand cuts strategy," as Jill Habig, founder of the Public Rights Project, a legal advocacy nonprofit supporting election administrators, told me at the time. Even if the Trump campaign's so-called election integrity program doesn't bring about significant voter intimidation, it could help them throw sand in the gears of the process, Habig warned. And as Politico's Alex Eisenstadt pointed out, should Trump once again attempt to overturn the election, he will already have in place tens of thousands of workers who could help with that effort. All told, it points to the extraordinary stress test our system will face this fall, an even greater one, perhaps, than that we faced 4 years ago. Bess Levin has been really busy this week, so I'm going to give her a little bit more time than we usually do. This first headline, 17 states are considering laws that would imprison librarians. This was published on April 18th. Once upon a time, working as a librarian in America was not considered a dangerous vocation. Rewarding, of course. Sweet, sure. Occasionally dull, yes, but a lot of jobs can be boring. Yet, for the most part, most people working as librarians in the U.S. did not wake up, head to work, and wonder, what are the chances I'm going to be charged with a crime for letting someone take out a book today? But thanks to GOP state legislators, that's now become a legitimate fear. The Washington Post reports that 17 states are currently weighing bills that would remove long-standing exemptions, protecting librarians from prosecution for distributing materials deemed inappropriate for minors, a carve-out that allows them to offer books containing accurate information on things like sex education without having to worry about going to prison. Those bills, per the Post, would look similar to an Arkansas law that was signed last year and later blocked that says school and public librarians can be sentenced to up to 6 years imprisoned or fined $10,000 for distributing obscene or harmful material to students under 18. The bill's definition of what constitutes harmful or obscene material is extremely broad and includes books and performances that, among other things, describe nudity. Similar laws have been signed into Indiana, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. While the Post found no instances of librarians being prosecuted under such laws to date, the Utah Library Association pointed to cases in Missouri, Texas, and South Carolina where the police were called and/or launched an investigation. And just the threat of prison time is having an understandably chilling effect. It has forged a poisonous atmosphere for librarians, said Megan Tarbert, a county library director in West Virginia and president of her state's library association. West Virginia considered a bill this year ending exemptions from prosecution over obscene material for school, public libraries, and materials, but it failed to pass. Even so, Tarbert says, she worries legislators will reintroduce the bill, scaring potential librarians away from the profession. It's going to be hard where you could go to jail for doing your job. West Virginia House Delegate Brandon Steele, who introduced a bill that would allow librarians to be prosecuted, told the Post the move is strictly about pornography, and on that limited basis, this isn't going to have the chilling effect people think it's going to. Of course, in practice, the legislation appears to be aimed not at actual harmful material, but the kind conservatives just don't like. As the Post notes, as book challenges spiked to historic highs over the past 2 years, the majority of objections targeted books by and about LGBTQ people and people of color. Speaking of book banning, on Tuesday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill restricting the number of challenges Floridians without children can make against books in public schools, claiming the book banning system is being abused. The idea that someone can use the parents' rights and the curriculum transparency to start objecting to every single book to try to make a mockery of this is just wrong, he said. The changes, which go into effect July 1st, mean that residents without a child in the public school district will only get to challenge one book a month. Sure, his office tried to blame the situation on activists who are trying to politicize Florida's book banning problem and not on book banning obsessed conservatives who have an issue with an illustrated adaptation of Anne Frank's diary, but it's an intentionally positive step nonetheless. Our next headline brings us a little local news. I'm here to represent Jesus Christ. Arizona Republicans block a second attempt to repeal Civil War-era abortion ban. This is published on the 17th. After Arizona Supreme Court reinstated the 1864 law banning virtually all abortions, including in cases of incest and rape, the response across the country was deafening and not in a good way. From people who believe in reproductive rights, sure, but also from many Republicans, including Donald Trump, who fear the move will cost the party elections. It went too far, the man who brags about killing Roe v. Wade told reporters, adding desperately, I'm sure that the governor and everybody else are going to bring it back into reason. But a week later, things have not been brought back into reason because Republicans in the state are apparently intent on letting the barbaric law stand. On Wednesday, Arizona Republicans blocked the second effort in 2 weeks to repeal the Civil War-era abortion ban. According to the New York Times, after GOP lawmakers initially resisted Democratic efforts to reverse the law last week, cajoling from Trump and Arizona Senate candidate Carrie Lake looked like it was going to translate to an about-face this week, with Democrats signaling that they were optimistic of having enough Republican support to secure a majority and send the repeal bill to the state Senate. But after a Democratic lawmaker attempted to bring forward legislation to repeal the ban, Republicans blocked it on procedural grounds, preventing a vote on the floor. The fact that we will not even entertain a motion to allow those who have been raped or pregnant by incest to be able to have an abortion is extremely, extremely disappointed, State Representative Alma Hernandez said on Wednesday. Why won't these cowards allow the vote to come to the floor? Rolandi Baker, who was sitting in the gallery, asked the Times, what are they afraid of? That it might just pass? That Arizona just might get ourselves out of the year 1864? Before the end of the Civil War? Before women had a right to vote? House Speaker Ben Toma, apparently unconcerned with the Arizonans who may need abortions now, said, the last thing we should be doing today is rushing a bill through the legislative process to repeal a law that has been enacted and reaffirmed by the legislature several times. Even more alarming, for those who not only believe in reproductive freedom, but that pesky idea of separation of church and state, were the remarks from Corinne Royster, an Arizona Republican Party precinct committee member. I'm here before representing the people in my precinct to represent Jesus Christ, she said. It doesn't have to be picture perfect for people to get pregnant. Should Republicans continue to block efforts to repeal the law, voters may have a chance to do it themselves, as signatures are currently being gathered to get a ballot measure enshrining abortion access in the state constitution on the November ballot. Our next headline, Melania Trump thinks the hush money trial is a disgrace, is probably still pissed at her husband for allegedly sleeping with a porn star. This is published on the 17th. When Donald Trump was charged last year by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office for allegedly trying to cover up the hush money payment he made to porn star Stormy Daniels, Melania Trump made her feelings on the situation pretty clear by opting not to attend his post-arraignment speech, despite it occurring at her own house. What are the former First Lady's thoughts on the matter 1 year later, with the trial now officially underway? According to a new report, they appear to have evolved, but only slightly. The New York Times' Katie Rogers, who wrote a book on First Ladies, reports that Melania has privately called the legal proceedings a disgrace and believes, per the Times, that the trial itself is unfair, according to people familiar with the matter. She apparently also shares the ex-president's opinion that the case amounts to election interference, yet it appears that the former First Lady's feelings with regard to the alleged affair her husband had, which he has long denied, have not changed, per the Times. In January 2018, when she first saw reports that her husband had paid off a porn star, Melania Trump was furious. She canceled a trip to Davos, Switzerland with Mr. Trump, made an impromptu visit to the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and then she jetted off to Mar-a-Lago, the Trump's beachside fortress in Palm Beach, Florida, where she spent part of her trip relaxing at the spa. She eventually reappeared only to take a separate car to Mr. Trump's State of the Union address and appear on the arm of a male military aide. As a criminal trial against Mr. Trump opened on Monday on charges that he had falsified records to cover up that sex scandal involving Stormy Daniels, Mrs. Trump did not appear. She has long privately referred to the case involving Ms. Daniels as his problem and not hers. As Rogers reported in her book, American Women, The Transformation of the Modern First Lady, from Hillary Clinton to Jill Biden, Melania's former press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, said that Melania was pissed at Trump when she first learned of the hush money payment and wanted him to be a little humiliated that she canceled the Davos trip and skipped town. In addition to not showing up for the first or second day of the criminal trial this week, the former First Lady has largely been absent on the campaign trail, including during Trump's Super Tuesday victory party, which, like the post-indictment speech last April, was also conveniently held at her house. Obviously, it would be a good look for Trump if his wife appeared with him in court or defended him in any way. And according to her former press secretary, Melania seems to know it. At the end of the day, she can make or break his candidacy, Grisham told the Times. And at the end of the day, she could probably make or break him. Our next headline, Republicans fan out to defend Trump in hopes he'll notice and pick them to be his VP. This is published on the 16th. As Republicans have proven countless times over the past 8 years, they don't need a reason to go on TV and defend Donald Trump against whatever awful, possibly criminal thing he's done on any given day. Whether it's downplaying his decision to store classified government documents in the bathroom, formally declaring he did not incite an insurrection on January 6th, or excusing his attacks on Jews, these people love nothing more than publicly going to bat for the guy, so much so that you'd think he was financially compensating them or had incriminating photos of them or something. But nope, they do it of their own free will and ask for nothing in return. As it happens, though, some of the people currently defending Trump against the Manhattan District Attorney's claim that he falsified business records to cover up the hush money payment he made to porn star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election do want something from the ex-president, to be named his 2024 running mate. And while they'd probably skip time with their own families to make excuses for him regardless, right now they're hoping their slavish devotion to him is rewarded in a big way. CNN reports that numerous Republicans, whose names have been floated as possible Trump VPs, are defending him on TV in the hopes that he'll be impressed by their unfounded notions and decide to give them the number two job. Said one GOP strategist, "Really, the assignment is nominally go defend Trump on TV. The assignment is actually go show that you're a really, really effective communicator so Trump believes he has you an ally and a surrogate that's going to be compelling," said Greg Keller, another Republican strategist. "The stakes are very high, not just for the president personally and politically, but also for his surrogates. They have to know, and I'm sure they all do, that everything you say is going to be noticed not just by the president, but by his closest advisors as well. It's not just going to be a situation where maybe you say something suboptimal and it gets lost in the mix or doesn't get noticed. That's not how things operate in Trump world. They know and hear about everything." On Monday in CNN, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum dubbed the proceedings a sham trial, claiming, "If this was brought against anybody other than President Trump, this would have been a misdemeanor." He contended that the alleged crimes constituted a boring business filing case, as though entertainment value is a requirement for prosecuting someone. According to CNN, Burgum has kept in regular touch with Trump officials and spoke with them as recently as the Sunday before his interview. On X, New York Representative Elise Stefanik attacked former Trump attorney Michael Cohen, writing in a post that sounded as if it had been dictated by Trump. "The DOJ still refuses to charge the disgraced, disbarred attorney who admitted his guilt. Now, Soros-funded Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg is relying on disgraced Michael Cohen as his key witness in his sham case. The double standard of justice is clear." Later, she asked people to RT if they agreed that the trial amounts to election interference. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, whose stock has apparently been rising in Trump world, chimed in similarly, writing, "What Alvin Bragg is doing to President Trump is a disgrace to the rule of law and the opposite of justice. It's also election interference." South Carolina Senator Tim Scott took things a step further, falsely claiming, "What the radical left is doing is not just election interference, it's election engineering. They will try everything and fail to stop Donald J. Trump." Vivek Ramaswamy, who per CNN, Trump told will not be his running mate but could get a cabinet gig, posted a nearly 3-minute long video to X, insisting the ex-president is being persecuted. Appearing on Fox News, Alabama Senator Katie Britt, who is also said to be under consideration as a running mate, said the trial is an excuse for the media not to talk about what a disaster this country is under Joe Biden, a line that Trump undoubtedly loved. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from the magazine, We'll check in on the Hollywood scene, maybe some more T. Swift news, who knows? But I'm sure there'll be plenty of politics and, of course, Bess Levin. So thank you for tuning in and have a great week, everybody.